Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Dirt. Want to thank you for taking some time out to listen to the podcast of our show, brought to you by Les Schwab Tires, doing the right thing since 1952.
There's a light shot. Beats it. Pass Ruiz into left. Wendell's going to try to score. Throw not in time. Rays win it on the fan.
This is Dirt and Sprague.
Springer drills one deep center field. This ball carrying it gone. George Springer, his 30th home run of the year. And the Astros retake the lead at 3-2.
With Andy Dirt Johnson and Brendan Sprague.
Should throw. Or is it?
Ball closers to football. A scrum as they dive for it at the 25. And the Cardinals have reclaimed it. A monster takeaway. And now another fumble. Notre Dame's got the ball back. Back-to-back fumbles. It's Jack Lamb who fell on it. You gotta be kidding.
Dirt and Sprague on 1080 The Fan.
All right, 12:02 in the Rose City. Time for Dirt and Sprague on Portland Sports Leader, 1080 The Fan. Brandon Sprague, Andy Dirt Johnson. Working another Monday afternoon.
It's a Monday. It's a Tuesday. It's Monday.
Tuesday. We worked Monday. A lot of you are here Tuesday, so we're redoing Monday on a Tuesday, and it makes Tuesday feel like a Monday.
It's all a blur for me, man.
Did that make sense?
It kind of made sense. It made sense to me. I think your math is, it's been solved in my head. I got that one.
Like, I saw a few people I'm friends with on the old Instagram account.
Sure.
I saw a couple people have to go into work. And nobody else was at their job either. Like, I'm all alone today. Or
I'm all alone.
Well, I'm getting a couple extra bucks. So I went in and I thought, okay, that's cool. You know, some other people I follow are working. And they text me today and they were like, yeah, dude, today feels like Monday.
It does.
And I said, I know it's weird because you worked Monday, but it didn't feel real because nobody else is around you.
There's a different vibe in the office when you're the only one in the office.
Much different. It's like, oh, it's still the weekend.
Right. And I don't know how other people's places of work are that way when you're like the only one in there. But for us, like, it's usually a much different dress code. Not that we dress up on days of work. Like, we wear shorts and t-shirts, you know, whatever.
I'm wearing a black t-shirt right now.
Yeah, and I usually go golf shorts and a polo. That's usually my go-to on a normal work day. But when there's nobody else in the building, I mean, you're in basketball shorts and a cutoff, essentially. Now, we actually had sleeves on yesterday, but it feels more like an official day of work when I'm not wearing basketball shorts. So today does have a Monday vibe to it.
It does, but we're here. We labored yesterday. We're back again, and we realize a lot of you guys were not hanging out with us.
What the hell were you all doing yesterday? Enjoying your day off, probably.
That would be my guess, is enjoying the coast. Yeah. It was like 71 degrees at the beach yesterday.
That's a nice little day at the beach right there.
You know, people coming back from big camping trips, or you're flying back into town. I think a lot of people found things to do.
Yeah, I think so. Labor Day is always a big one. Everybody's got the day off for the most part. It's kind of the last hurrah for a lot of people. Now, it did throw me off last week when school was back in session for some school districts. Like, that's just weird that you're starting before Labor Day, because that was like always one of the main staples. You start after Labor Day. So that's kind of tough for those kids. They go for 3 days, and then all of a sudden it's a weekend. You get a three-day weekend, now you're back. So for most people, this is like the official start of the year. Summer's over. Here we go, after Labor Day.
Yeah, we took our oldest daughter to second grade today, and we left. We're probably 20 minutes from the school, driving-wise. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a little further out. We get there. We left at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
Her school starts at 7:45. We thought,
hey, got plenty of time.
Yeah, we're going to go. We're going to park. We're going to walk her in. We'll do the whole, hey, first day, woo-hoo, good luck, have fun. We didn't park until 7:52. That school is not built to handle more than about 30 adults.
That is parenting of the year right there. You leaving late made your kid be 7 minutes late to her first day of second grade.
Well, hold on. If I told you you
Did you write a teacher's note, parents' note? My bad. Kid
no,
was late.
The teacher, I think most of the teachers expected that because there was still about a half mile of cars behind us.
Yeah, it's a bit of a cluster F.
But if I told you you live 20 minutes from something.
Yeah.
You would kind of think 45 minutes out's good enough-ish, right?
Plenty of time to get there.
No.
No, it didn't happen.
Not close. Not close at all. And then you see as you walk in, you walk your kid in. It's the third time you've done this now because of kindergarten, first grade. Well, you could even count preschool if you take your kids to preschool. And then you just start counting the moms that are crying.
They still do it in second grade, huh?
Oh, dude. Second, third, first, kindergarten,
doesn't matter.
I can see
kindergarten. That one makes sense to me because you're like officially starting school. Like not preschool, obviously, is out there. But the first time you drop them off at kindergarten, like that's a big deal.
Well, kindergarten's all day now.
Yeah,
it's not half days
anymore. So it's the first time. I mean, you're dropping them off. They're gone all day. You're not going to see them until the school's out. So I can see that one being emotional. Like that's a pretty iconic moment in your kid's life. But wouldn't you get used to it? And I feel like eventually, now, second grade, you're probably not there quite yet. But at some point, it turns when they, A, don't want you to bring them in to drop them off at class. And they're just essentially like, go, like, leave me alone.
She basically didn't care much if we were there or not.
There wasn't, like, any of the, like, clingy stuff. Because I bet you get that for, you know, kindergarten, like, first day of school, like, little nerves.
She was, yeah, you get that in that. But she was more like, I don't have any of my friends in this class this year. And then at lunch, they can't sit wherever they want. They have to sit with their class.
Oh, that's kind of a bummer.
So I'm like, but you'll still see them at recess. You'll see them at different little things you guys do. And it's not like your friends are going away. But she's like, I don't know anybody. I'm like, you say this every year, and then you make, like, four new friends.
Yeah, and you got more kids at your birthday party. You're just widening your circle of friends.
God, the birthday parties. Don't get me started. Can we stop this at like 8 years old now?
I find that fantastic that your kid was late to her first day of school. That sounds like something I would do as a parent. I'm not going to lie, man. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you. Yeah, we'll get you there when we get you there. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, when I saw the line of cars, I thought, they're not caring about attendance today. This is the day where they go, yeah, you were 25 minutes late. Whatever, Billy.
Don't worry. I think one of my favorite going to school stories as a kid was when my brother and I were both in middle school together and we had to go to the orthodontist. My parents would always schedule like the appointments the same day, like two birds with one stone. You both go in, get your appointment done, and then we'll go drop you off at the same school. And my dad spilled... his cup of coffee tipped over in the car on the way to school, and it spilt on my brother's pants. And so he had this, like, big brown stain down the side of his pants.
Oh, no.
And it's one of those, like, embarrassing, like, eighth grade things. Like, yeah, I can't go to school like this. Yeah. And he was like, no, get your ass in there. You're going to school. And he had to walk around the rest of the day with, like, a coffee stain on the left leg of his pants. And embarrassment ensued. Like, you know, that's how parents should do it.
I only had one moment with my mom, kindergarten. She didn't bring any of the stuff she needed for me to be able to go to school. And I was in daycare, and I remember she took me, and I saw my class, and I saw two little buddies that I knew from daycare. Yeah. And I was jacked. Yeah. I'm like, dude, I finally get to get a daycare. I go to school.
It's a big deal.
And the school was like, he can't go today. You have to bring back this stuff. And we didn't have it. And so I started crying. I remember this too. I was pissed.
Just wailing away.
She's like, why are you crying? I'm like, because I hate going to daycare. I want to go to school.
I'm a big boy.
I'm a big boy, mama.
Come on.
My pants are fitting. So, you know, that's what back to school day really is.
Well, happy back to school day for everybody and for the rest of you who had the day off yesterday. Welcome to the official start of the year.
Yeah.
You know my fiance got Saturday at Starbucks? Or not Saturday, Sunday when we got back?
I do because they were released earlier this year than ever before.
Pumpkin spice latte.
Pumpkin spice latte.
Yeah. She also put a...
I don't think it's too early for her, by the way.
Really?
I think once you get to September, I'm cool with you doing the fall thing. Even early September, it's still hot. It's still summer-ish.
I disagree completely, but okay.
Yeah. We're going to disagree on this. I'm not even like a pro, I drink pumpkin spice guy.
Yeah, not a big pumpkin spice bro.
And I think it's gone extreme here. Cereals, deodorants. I mean, you name it, they've got it pumpkin spiced.
Yeah.
But I think once you hit September and October to me, I kind of mush them together a little bit. Like the wife was like, can I take some Halloween stuff out? I said,
oh, no.
You can put a couple things up that are tiny.
Wow.
We're talking like sugar holders, man. Yeah, like things you wouldn't even notice if you came to my house.
Yeah, I had to fight that battle. She has a couple weeks off before school starts back up again. And she had told me the other day that like next week she's going to start decorating for Halloween. And I put the kibosh on that thing.
You
like,
said no.
That is not happening. It's not. You can't mix them together because the weather hasn't turned yet. Like, September is one of the nicest months out of the year here.
But October is always pretty nice, too. It's not the weather really saying, turns in October.
But it's more so you get a little more rain, and it's darker. Like it's already getting dark at what time? Like, 8 o'clock
eight,
now,
yeah,
right?
Ish,
so
yeah.
By the time you get to October, it's up into, like, 7, late 6s. Like, you're starting to get into that fall kind of vibe. Then I'm all for it. You can put the candles out and have the pumpkins around the house, but when I'm still coming home and barbecuing and like flip-flops and the windows are open and it's 85 degrees out, I can't mentally go to a place where it's Halloween yet. I'm not ready.
But how much of that do you think involves you not having kids versus my opinion might be slated because I'm
sure.
Kids yours are in school now.
Yours is slightly different. Yeah. Your kids might want to have pumpkins up. I get that, but
we shop a little more than you, so that means we're always seeing a little more Halloween decorations in August.
Sure. See, but then when does it stop? If you put up Halloween decorations now, do you put up Christmas stuff at like the beginning of November?
Well, unfortunately, this year we won't put anything up because we're going to Vietnam for damn near the whole month.
That's true. Yeah, you guys won't even have a tree this year.
I might put some lights up before we leave, so when we come back, you
get something on the house,
or maybe I'll get a little tiny Christmas tree on the 22nd when we land. I don't know.
You find one of the leftover trees; it's all dry. Right out at that point.
It would be weird as somebody who observes Christmas, like you celebrate it, you do the gift thing. As somebody that celebrates Christmas, it's going to be very odd if I don't have a tree on Christmas.
Yeah, because you're going to be home for Christmas Day.
Yeah.
You got to have something up in the house, put a few things underneath it, and get the feelings going.
I think holidays is always dictated by your life situation. No kids? I get it.
Yeah, I put that. No. No. We are not decorating for Halloween yet, okay?
Pretty soon you're going to have two kids and you're going to lose that fight. That's what's going to happen.
I'll grant you the last week of September grace period, okay? You get a couple of days at the end of the month if you want to do it and have them up for October 1st. But on like September 10th, no, we're not carving pumpkins yet, okay?
God, you sound like a dictator. Let's find out what's on tap for today's show.
Dirt and Sprague know what's brewing.
I'm not paid to be bold. I'm paid to be right.
There's a lot of sporting events that you say, oh, I got to go do that.
This is What's on Tap, poured by Pelican Brewing Company, born at the beach on 1080. The Fan.
What's on Tap, brought to you in The Fan by Pelican Brewing Company, born at the beach, online at pelicanbrewing.com. We'll jump into the Ducks and Auburn matchup that was. Some of you heard that stuff yesterday, but we're going to bring it back for the portion of our audience that wasn't around. We've got Adam Rittenberg of the ESPN blog type, friend of the show. He's going to join us to talk Ducks Auburn. He was in Texas, the Pac-12 weekend, the SEC weekend, and some more with Adam Rittenberg. Pete Thamel wrote an article for Yahoo Sports, really kind of just bashing Mario Cristobal.
Yeah, it was fun to read Saturday night in the height of the misery of losing that game.
I'll give you a blurb. This is one little blurb from his story, which I put it up on our Facebook page if you want to check it out. Pete Thamel's a pretty good writer. He had this one, quote, Cristobal branded as one of the worst game managers in all of the Power Five. This is simple and true. End quote. So that's part of his story. We'll dive into that one a little bit. We'll talk about the Beavers. Defensively, they look like they're just as bad as they were last year. We'll get into the NFL trades with Jadeveon Clowney and Laramie Tunzel. We got NFL True or False coming up at 1:30, crunch time. We got general college football to get to. Willie Taggart blames this on their loss Saturday against Boise State after being up 31-13.
Ooh.
And we'll talk some Pac-12 and probably jump back into the Ducks in the final hour. That's what's on tap for today's show, and we're going to start with Ducks and Auburn. What is your biggest takeaway from the Ducks and Auburn game? We'll start there. 55305 is the Better You Today text line. Dirt and Sprague with you on this Tuesday on 1080 The Fan. All right, well, the Oregon Ducks start off 0-1. They drop their game to Auburn, 27-21. Bo Nix gets the late touchdown pass with 9 seconds to go. And we'll get to the time part of that at 12:45, but yeah, I know some of our listeners hanging out. We appreciate you guys being around yesterday, but for a large portion that maybe wasn't that they were out of town, you're just getting back, maybe you missed most of the show. Let's give our takes again. So Oregon beats, or they lose to Auburn 27-21. They were up 21-6 with four to go in the third quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a Stanford-like ending to their game. What was the biggest takeaway for you in that matchup?
I think the biggest takeaway was just a level of frustration because you felt like you, for chunks of that game, outplayed Auburn. You felt like you had the horses to hang, and you showed that you could go toe-to-toe with what is a good but not great SEC team. But you can't make the mistakes that Oregon made in the first half, and you can't coach the way they coach in the second half and expect to come away with wins. And I think that was the biggest frustration, being you came in with a question mark on coaching. You came in wondering, how is Mario Cristobal going to handle certain situations? How is Marcus Arroyo going to call plays in certain situations? And in the first half, at least, I think you felt pretty good about both of those. I know Oregon called a timeout before their first play, but they ended up scoring a touchdown on their opening drive, so that was somewhat forgotten. And without a couple of mistakes in the first half, you're up 28-3, and maybe this is a different conversation, but that's not the world we're living in. The world we're living in, it was 14-6. You left them around, you let them hang around. And then even when you went up 21-6, that should be a moment your team capitalizes, puts the nail in the coffin, and finds a way to close the game. And I think there's shared responsibility on both the players, on Herbert, on the wide receivers, defensively late, allowing some things to happen. And then the play calling, both at first being overly aggressive and then being too conservative. You know, they went up 21-6, and everybody said they were conservative the whole second half. When they were up 21-6, seven of their eight next plays were pass plays. Now, they weren't able to throw the ball efficiently, and they punted it away, and that was a big part of why they lost. And then you got late in the game, and you decided, okay, let's go super conservative, and you ran the ball on a 3rd-and-7, and you checked down for a 5-yard completion on a 3rd-and-14. And so you didn't really know what kind of identity you wanted to play with in the second half, where you started aggressive, and then you got way too conservative, and then the 4th-down play call where you had to call 2 timeouts was a total cluster F of epic proportions. And that's the frustrating part. It was a game similar to what Washington had last year, where you came away with it saying, man, you should have won that one. You no business losing that game. You're up 21-6 in the second half with 4 minutes left in the third quarter. No business losing that game, but you found a way to dribble it off your foot. Now you got to bounce back.
Yeah, I think the frustrating thing, Dirt, it's not even that it's just Auburn again. It's not that you lost a game in Dallas again. It's that Oregon has had some really good wins in this really long run of theirs, but you're looking for that one win in the one moment where the whole country is seeing it and going, oh, okay. Like, they've had plenty of huge Pac-12 wins in this run, right? They've won a Fiesta Bowl. They've won a Rose Bowl. But they've also lost to Ohio State. They lost to LSU. They've lost to Auburn. Like, in some of their standalone games, when people are watching, and this is one of those, they haven't had the most success. And I think that's an unfortunate part, I think, from the Duck angle is you completely outplayed them. I mean, I was listening to your roundtable show yesterday with Anthony Newman. He was right. Like, people can think he's a homer, but he's also right. They outplayed Auburn, I think, mostly in the first half, mm-hmm. and then even in chunks in the second until Auburn got the momentum and it turned around for him.
Mm-hmm.
When they had that fumble, that was it for me. That was, I said, okay, Auburn's going to fight back here and make this very interesting. And you mentioned the play calling, not only 7 of the 8 passes, 18 of their final 24 plays were pass plays.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where I don't know. I don't know how the communication works on some of their pass plays. Like, we don't like to count the bubble screen, right? Or those little dump, little delay, draw almost type plays. How many of those pass plays are designed to say, Herbert, hit Verdell, wait a couple seconds, hit Verdell, versus Justin Herbert not trusting guys that are out there because they're 3rd and 4th on the depth chart, and him seeing, oh, Jalen Redd's right here, or C.J. Verdell, or whoever is right here, they can pick up some yards, and largely they weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, they were getting 3 or 4 yards, and it was mainly the 3-yard type. They had 13 rush yards, I believe, in the second half.
I know C.J. Verdell had 5 carries for 12 yards. I don't know about the team, but I know he only had 12.
So, you know, you look at their second half performance, and you just don't, I don't think you can pinpoint it to one particular thing. I know a lot of Duck fans yesterday and today are still looking at Marcus Arroyo
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, it's play calling. That's as simple as it is. It's play calling. It's not that simple. Your head coach completely didn't know the rule about a player returning on it. That's kind of a problem there. We mentioned the Pete Thamel article, and look, you may not agree with everything he writes in it, but one thing he's right about is killing clock and not putting yourself in a situation where there's X amount of time left when you could have killed X amount of time. I just think there are little things from a lot of different areas that led to that loss. It wasn't one particular thing.
No.
The Marcus Arroyo thing is going to become annoying to me because if they look good the next 3 weeks, not just their two non-conference, but they're also their first conference game, are we going to still crap on the dude? Like, I'm not telling you he's a world-class play caller by any means. Some of those play calls were absolutely predictive and predictive, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
But nobody's bitching about it in the first half, right? Nobody's. Right. That's the thing about offensive player calls that I do feel sympathy for is when it goes well, nobody really says anything. When it goes poorly and people don't like you, that's when they jump. And in this moment, he is one of three or four things I would pinpoint and say,
sure,
this is why they lost, and that's all people point at. Arroyo, Arroyo, Arroyo.
Sure, or Herbert got outplayed by Bo Nix, or, you know, whatever.
Well, he didn't get outplayed by Bo Nix. That's crazy statistically, and if you watch that game, he didn't get outplayed. What I would say is you have to be at least this. You have to admit that you're somewhat disappointed that he didn't have that moment.
Oh, without a doubt. And he needed to have it in the second half. It goes back to, and this is why it's always tough to break up this puzzle of how much blame you give to certain guys, how much of it is on the play calls and certain situations that the offense coordinator put them in, how much of it was on Herbert not being more aggressive and maybe taking shots or using his legs a little bit more like we saw Bo Nix do, and how much of it was on the wide receivers not being able to create space. And I think the Arroyo stuff is valid in terms of you have to be able to make adjustments throughout the course of a football game. Like, that was always the big thing when Taggart was here, and you just saw it again with him on Saturday when they blew a 31-13 lead. Like, there weren't many second half adjustments, and you didn't change much about the way you were doing things. And I thought that was, you saw the first half of Oregon come in with a game plan that was solid. Auburn couldn't get pressure with a four-man rush. Herbert had time to throw. They dominated the line of scrimmage on both sides of the ball, and you were feeling great about the way you were executing. Well, guess what? There's good coaches on both sides, and Auburn went into the locker room and they said, okay, we need to run the ball more on offense because we can start pushing them around a little bit if they're on the field a lot, and that started to happen. And we're going to stack the line of scrimmage. We're going to put nine guys in the box. We're not going to allow Oregon to run the football effectively, which they didn't in the second half, and we're not going to allow their receivers any room to move on the outside. We're going to blitz. We're going to pressure. We're going to bring the heat at them because that's the only way we feel like we can stop Oregon. And that should have been Oregon's coaching staff should have seen that coming. All right, they're playing soft zones and they're not blitzing and they're playing back on their heels a little bit in the first half. They're going to dial up the pressure in the second half. They're down 14-6. They don't really have a choice. They can't play on their heels the rest of the game. And that's where I think you look at Arroyo and the coaching staff of saying, okay, when Auburn threw that counterpunch of this is how we're going to defend you, what's your response? How do you find a way to handle that? And again, this gets back to, is it Herbert? Is it receivers? Is it all play calling? The biggest frustration that I had in the second half was just simply not taking shots downfield. Like, I can't remember, and maybe somebody can, one attempt longer than 20, 25 yards in the second half outside of the drive you scored the touchdown on your opening drive of the third quarter.
Well, they didn't have one.
Right?
I can tell you that for a fact.
Any shots down
one.
The field, you didn't attempt it. And whether it's there or not, and whether it's completed or not, I just think to keep a defense honest, if they're going to bring that much heat and that much pressure, whether it's just lobbing one up to Spencer Webb and have him go catch another jump ball or send in Jalen Redd, like, you just got to keep a defense honest. And when everything's underneath and in front of the defense, it becomes easy to stop.
I think this a good point is somebody texts in at 55305. The red flag for me was they called a timeout before running any play to start the game. And I thought the same thing in the moment. And then when they responded,
and they ended up scoring a touchdown on that drive.
Right. But what I mean by that is I was also concerned by that. And then they responded really well. When they called the back-to-back timeouts with the Herbert confusion about substituting, we're actually going to talk to Chris Ball tomorrow at 12:15 on our show. And we're going to ask him about that because that was one of those. It was just very strange how you don't see that very often. Back-to-back timeouts, especially your last two, you need them. The game's getting kind of tight there.
My sense on that, honestly, was that I think Justin Herbert did it on his own. Just from my vantage point, it looked like...
Well, I'm just surprised nobody on that staff...
Sure.
And that was part of the Emil's piece that stuck out to me. Not one person on that staff knew the rule?
Right. Well, and that's where I think they did, and they didn't tell Herbert he can go back in. I think Herbert went back in on his own because they called the initial timeout after he got hurt, so that was the first one. And then Herbert took the field, and it was like, wait a minute. And then the refs had to send him back, and then there was confusion.
I just, I'll say this. He's going to get... Arroyo's going to get the most heat. And he's the one that's really going to be talked about in job security, all that stuff, because he makes the big money. That fourth down run, like, that's a bad call, right?
That's a bad call.
I also kind of hope my senior quarterback can recognize the defense is knowing exactly what you're running. Like, those little moments do stand out.
Well, he wasn't in the game.
Who?
Herbert.
He was in the game in that play.
On the fourth down play, he was not. That was Shuck because he couldn't come back in.
Touche. Okay.
He got hurt, and that they tried to put him back for the fourth down, and that's why they had to call the second timeout.
Yes, even on that play, it's like, how do you not drop something more creative than that? We're just going to run to the left. Auburn figured that out right away. As soon as they saw the formation, they knew what that play was.
Right. I'd almost rather, in that situation, if that's what you're going to run, you might as well just punt it and try and pin a freshman quarterback inside his own 10-yard line and say, okay, you got to go the length of the field to score.
But I'm not gonna tell you where to put percentages of blame. Everybody's going to have their own. Cristobal, Arroyo, what have you. I just viewed that loss, as cliche as it sounds, I just think there's a few different people you could point the finger at and say, this did not go well or did not go how I thought it would. Hence why they played poorly in the second half and couldn't win that game.
Yeah, and I said it on the pregame show too. We overanalyze this stuff all the time, but essentially what it comes down to is who controls the line of scrimmage for the majority of the game and who makes the mistakes and who capitalizes on mistakes.
Right.
And when you analyze it that way, Oregon controlled the line of scrimmage in the first half. They couldn't in the second half because of adjustments by Auburn. Auburn threw two interceptions, so they made two mistakes. Guess what? Oregon didn't get any points out of them. Mm-hmm. Oregon made two mistakes with the dropped touchdown pass in the end zone. Auburn ended up kicking a field goal on the other end.
Well, you could say three mistakes of the
field
goal, too.
Sure, with the field goal, and then the fumbled snap, which Auburn then, or fumbled exchange, and Auburn ran it all the way back. So Oregon made two mistakes. Auburn got 6 points out of it. They ended up winning the game by six. Like, the reality is, for all the blame you want to give on the coaching staff, one, if you catch that touchdown in the back of the end zone and you don't fumble on your own 8-yard line, which is inexcusable, especially for a senior quarterback, you win that game.
You easily win that game.
And with all of that being said, you were 6 inches away from getting a stop on fourth and three before that final touchdown. Bo Nix converted a fourth and three. They had to review it. He barely got it. Like, all of this being said, all this blame, all this criticism, you were 6 inches away or two plays away from winning that game. And that comes full circle back to why it was such a frustrating loss.
Yeah, no doubt about it. We'll have more on this game. Coming up next, another guy that was there is Adam Rittenberg for ESPN. He saw this game. He's going to join us to talk about that, the Pac-12 weekend, and a whole lot more. His thoughts on Oregon's loss to Auburn. Adam Rittenberg is next.
In this wide world of sports, some stories can slip through the cracks.
Now, before we do this, let's go over the ground rules.
This is the Daily Ticker, where Dirt and Sprague visit the insiders that are covering the stories you've heard about, and some you haven't.
How'd you do that? Actually, I'm not even mad. It's amazing.
The Daily Ticker with Dirt and Sprague on 1080 The Fan.
All right, 12:35, Daily Ticker time. We were talking Oregon and Auburn, and one gentleman that was there in attendance and saw Auburn come back to beat the Ducks 27-21 was Adam Rittenberg of ESPN. You can catch him all over ESPN.com, SportsCenter, ESPN+, and he's on Twitter at ESPN Rittenberg. Give him a follow. We tweeted out his show handle with our show page, and he joins us now. Adam, thanks for the time here in Portland, man. We appreciate it. I'll just start with the game. What were your thoughts on Auburn's comeback in that second half?
Sure, guys. It's good to be with you. I think it was an impressive comeback on a number of levels, especially, you know, doing it with a true freshman making his first start on that stage at quarterback in Bo Nix. And, you know, the fact that I know Oregon was a little shorthanded at receiver, so was Auburn. Anthony Schwartz was a real explosive player who wasn't out there for them. But, you know, you could see it turning as the game went along. You know, I think you could see that the line of scrimmage, and that was one thing that Gus Malzahn talked about after the game, that they made that a point of emphasis. They felt Oregon had controlled the line of scrimmage in the first half, and Oregon did, and Auburn started to change that a little bit. I wouldn't say it was the best game I've seen from their defensive line. They weren't as noticeable as you kind of come to expect with Auburn, but Big Cat Bryant made some plays. Coe made a play towards the end, and then, you know, Oregon, obviously, I thought they played really well defensively for most of the game, but you get a hot quarterback at the end, and your offense isn't really doing much, and, you know, the better team, you know, tends to rise at the end. I think Auburn probably had a little bit more talent overall than Oregon, and it showed at the end of the game.
Yeah, that defense was on the field for a lot in the second half. Eventually, they're going to break down. What was your biggest takeaway from the Oregon angle? I mean, it's a tough one for fans. Granted, because they've had struggles in that stadium, and the Auburn National Championship game, of course, sticks out, and they lose on another essentially last play. And a lot of Oregon fans feel like they probably should have won that game, and they had it. They just made too many mistakes in the first half. What was your takeaway from the Oregon angle?
Yeah, just to your point, they lost the game in the first half. They should have been up, I would say, at least 21 points, given how they played and how Auburn played. I mean, you know, and again, mistakes are part of the game. But you just can't have an exchange issue with a veteran quarterback and a veteran running back after your receiver, or sorry, your return man gives you a great chance to score. You have to score there. I mean, at the very least, a field goal. And they basically, it goes from, you know, a likely touchdown or at worst a field goal to a field goal on the other end, which is fortunate because the Oregon defense came up big. But I think there's certainly some things to build on, but also some concerning issues, just the inability to control the line of scrimmage in the second half. You're wearing down a little bit defensively against the quarterback who I think has a long way to go as a passer in Bo Nix, even though he played well towards the end of the game. And then there's the coaching issues. I'm sure you guys have talked about them. You know, I know that Stanford last year and this game were different, but those are pretty glaring mistakes on the sideline. And that's the difference when you get into games like that. Mario and his staff have done a tremendous job in terms of building up the talent level of the program. But coaching matters, and it's going to make a difference sometimes. And I think in part it made the difference on Saturday.
Adam Rittenberg, ESPN, is our guest joining us to talk about the Oregon-Auburn game. What are your thoughts on Justin Herbert?
Very, very impressed. I mean, I think anyone that's criticizing Justin Herbert or saying he's the reason that they lost is out of their mind. I think he was really good for much of that game, especially in the first half. You're showing his athleticism, showing his arm strength, you know, obviously not playing with a full deck as far as the receivers go. And that certainly could have made a difference even towards the end of the game. But I really liked what I saw from Justin. And I think he's in, you know, in shape to have a great year if they don't let that loss really linger. And I don't think they will. So I came away impressed with his vision, his arm strength, his athleticism, and I think he's really everything you want in a quarterback.
Yeah. Yeah, the coaching angle I do find really interesting for Oregon, because that was an issue going back, as you mentioned, to last year, and fans are not huge on Marcus Arroyo, and then that second half happens, and now it's just escalated to an even higher level. What do you want to see most from the coaching staff moving forward? Because, as you mentioned, the recruiting angle has been great for Oregon, and they're stockpiling it with talent and the best recruiting class in the history of the program last year. But you got to have both. You got to have the Jimmys and the Joes and the X's and the O's. What do you want to see most from their coaching staff moving forward the rest of the season?
Well, I think it's hard to be great at everything. It's hard to be great at recruiting and be, you know, elite in-game coaches. But I think it's something you have to evaluate. You have to acknowledge that you can't have an issue like you had on the sideline with those two timeouts, just too valuable in that situation. It's an unfortunate deal that Justin, you know, has that injury, which wasn't serious, but at that point in time in the game, right before a key fourth and one,
right.
But you have to be prepared. And that's where the great coaches, the in-game coaches are. They're prepared for everything. They don't panic and they find a way to overcome things that just naturally happen over the course of the game. As far as the Arroyo criticism, I just point to the fact that they came out and scored a touchdown on their first possession of each half. That's pretty good for me. I think he called a good game overall. You're dealing with an excellent defensive line. I thought Auburn's linebackers really rose to the occasion as well in the second half, especially Tut, 33, was flying around. And so, you know, I think to really pile on there is probably a little bit unfair, although, you know, from an Oregon standpoint, you want to be able to run the ball for an entire game, not just for a half or for right. 2.5 quarters. And so it all goes together. But I just think to dismiss some of these issues that have happened late in the game, you have to be a tough critic as a coach, and you ultimately have to be prepared for everything that happens.
Absolutely. Adam Rittenberg, ESPN, is our guest on Twitter, at ESPN Rittenberg. Give him a follow. One of the major college football writers for ESPN. I had somebody tweet me over the weekend, Adam, a random, like, hey, the Pac-12 sucks. I just want you to remember that. And then I looked at the slate, and I said, okay, half the ACC lost their games. The SEC had 3 of their 4 losses were embarrassingly bad losses. If you took Clemson, Bama, Ohio State, and Oklahoma, if you just took those 4 programs out, couldn't you make an argument, Adam, that really all these conferences are generally the same outside of the monsters in college football?
Without a doubt. You know, again, it is, we're in that conference discussion, especially this time of year, because of the non-conference play. But, you know, yeah, you're right. Does it matter that the Tennessee, a team that was going nowhere, lost to Georgia Southern? Yeah, it's embarrassing for Tennessee, but it doesn't affect the SEC's playoff picture, or that Missouri lost to Wyoming on the road. I mean, Missouri's been a nice story, but, you know, they're not going to be in the playoff. Neither is South Carolina. So you can really do that with every conference. The problem for the Pac-12 is that Oregon, if they win this game, they are in the playoff conversation, and they beat a team that of relevance and a team that might go on to a pretty good season in the SEC. We'll see how it goes with Auburn. And that didn't happen. And so, yeah, I mean, you still have you know, Washington winning their game convincingly, and Utah impressive on defense, especially in the Holy War. And you know, Stanford had a nice win against Northwestern. So you have some other teams that played well. And I don't think Arizona or Oregon State's performance should be held against the Pac-12 too much, just like Tennessee's and Wyoming Missouri shouldn't be held against the SEC. But we just get into that discussion a lot this time of year.
Yeah. What were the biggest takeaways for you week one? I mean, it was not a lot of marquee games, I guess, some shocking upsets, some big comebacks. What stood out to you the most from week one of college football?
I think Clemson still looks really good. That's not a shock. Same with Alabama. I think Jalen Hurts, what he was able to do, and I know Houston's not a great defense, and he'll face other defenses, even in the Big 12, that are a little bit more talented. But the way that he is integrated into that offense with Lincoln Riley was really good. I know he wasn't pleased with the outcome, but I think a lot of us that were watching saw some really good things for Oklahoma on both offense and defense. And so they're a really interesting team on a number of levels because of the recent Heisman Trophy winners, because Jalen Hurts coming from Alabama is so unique. And then defensively with Alex Grinch, a guy that you probably know from his time in the Pac-12 at Washington State, stepping in as a defensive coordinator, trying to improve one of the nation's worst units. So we're going to learn a lot more this week. And LSU in Texas is a massive game, probably the first true big time game of the year, other than maybe Auburn, Oregon. And then, you know, Texas A&M and Clemson should be a revealing game to a degree. So, but I think the Oklahoma and Jalen Hurts storyline and really all the transfer quarterbacks, whether it's Justin Fields at Ohio State, he looks pretty good, and some of the others are going to be a story throughout the season.
Anything we can pub for you, Adam? Anything you want to put out there to the masses for people for coming on our show?
Well, it was great to be on with you guys. I'll have a piece on Thursday, kind of opportunity week for some of the Group of Five coaches that may be moving up to bigger jobs, and even some of the Power Five coordinators. You know, Luke Fickell, Ohio State alum, now at Cincinnati. He's going to be taking his team into the Horseshoe to face the Buckeyes. So huge opportunity for him. Jeff Munkin of Army, who I just spoke to about an hour ago, he's taking Army into the Big House to face Michigan. So there's a number of those chances that, you know, and they're all massive underdogs, but man, if one of them pulls off a win, it's going to do wonders for that coach and that program. So I'll be looking at those guys on Thursday.
Well, that piece sounds great, man. And even if they don't win, at least they can cover and make people still happy and root for Luke Fickell and Army all year long. Adam Rittenberg, ESPN, one of the national college football writers on Twitter at ESPN Rittenberg. He was in Dallas for Oregon and Auburn, our guest here on the Daily Ticker. Thanks so much for joining us, Adam. We always love having you on, and I'm sure we'll have you on sometime down the road.
Anytime, guys. Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Absolutely. There we go. Adam Rittenberg, his thoughts. You know, you hear what he says there, and there's criticism, but there's almost no criticism. You know what I mean? Like, was play calling perfect? No. But he felt like Marcus Arroyo had a pretty good game calling the game.
Right.
The offensive defensive lines, they look good until they didn't.
Yeah.
It just, there's criticism and then there's not.
That's why it's such a weird game to talk about.
It is a very weird game, but it doesn't sit well with people when you blow a 21-6 lead late in the third quarter. We'll talk about it some more. Pete Thamel of Yahoo Sports, he thinks Mario Cristobal is the worst in-game manager in the Power Five. We'll talk about that article and some more things next. Oregon Auburn on the Fan. All right, 12:49 on the Fan. We'll get to Oregon State coming up in 10 minutes. Their defense looked woof. Pete Thamel of Yahoo Sports, he wrote an article in the post game of Oregon-Auburn. And in it, he kind of just goes at Mario Cristobal. He said, Mario Cristobal, how he blew Oregon's shot at Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically just runs down their last few possessions and how if they would have just run their play clock down to like one, hiked it, ran their play.
Yeah.
They would have killed enough time. There were multiple times where they hiked the ball with 17 seconds left on the game clock or the play clock, and then 14 seconds and then 15 seconds. He counted up the seconds and he says, if you just run this down and change your style a little bit to kill clock, Auburn wouldn't have had 9 seconds. You would have killed 15 seconds total. They made that pass at hiking with 15 seconds left.
Right.
They either had to have kicked the field goal or tried a bigger play earlier to get down the field to either be in field goal range or to try another one. So he just goes through an article and says, Mario Cristobal blew this game for Oregon. He compared it to Stanford in the post game, and I guess Cristobal didn't like that, so we're probably not asking that question, although I'll do it. I'll bite the bullet on that one because I do think there's similarities to him. But he said Cristobal is the worst game manager in the Power Five.
Not a glowing review. And I don't know. It's hard to speak for all the coaches in the Power Five. I don't even know how many of them I could name across the country.
You'd have to, Dirt, in that instance with that kind of thing, you'd have to take all of the good teams.
Sure, the teams that are relevant.
The good to great conversation teams. How many of those are really in the Power Five? And then say, is he right on this?
Well, and I think the Rittenberg thing was more like the clock management stuff. Like, I get that. I get that angle. But that to me wasn't ultimately the reason why Oregon lost the game, right? Like, if I'm going to do a power ranking of number of reasons why Oregon found a way to lose and blow a 21-6 lead, I don't really know where not running a few extra seconds off the clock would fall into my list, starting with mistakes, second half execution, calling too many timeouts in bad situations, not being prepared for this or that. Like, clock management to me was a little bit further down the list, where I do think the criticism is completely fair against him. As Rittenberg pointed out, the great coaches know how to have something prepared and ready in every situation that is thrown at you. And again, I don't know what the reasoning was or who was ultimately at fault for when Justin Herbert went back into the game after the initial timeout, when he wasn't allowed to go back into the game after the initial timeout. Whether Herbert ran onto the field on his own without even talking to anybody and just told Chuck, I'm going in, or whether the coaching staff didn't know the rules, said, yes, you can go back in, then had to call another timeout. But those are the kind of examples, I think, that stand out of you didn't have something ready in that moment. And then when it came time to actually run a play, you had a backup quarterback in the game. Auburn knew you weren't going to let him do anything. And you turned around and handed it off with the running back starting 9 yards behind the line of scrimmage. I get that you have confidence in your offensive line, and they won some of those battles throughout the game, thinking of the fourth and goal situation on your opening drive when you did the same thing. You turned around, you handed it off, and you were able to score a touchdown. The difference was Herbert was in the game then, and he wasn't on the fourth down. So like, those are the coaching mistakes and miscues that I look back on, and you just kind of pull your hairs out a little bit. Where, though, I do think you need to be fair in the criticism, though, is ultimately the players are the ones on the field that are making the mistakes and doing things to hurt their chances to win the game as well. Like, it goes hand in hand. Like, the Stanford game, yes, he got criticized for handing the ball off. C.J. Verdell fumbles. Stanford scores a touchdown or a field goal, whatever it was, and you end up going overtime. I get that. You probably should have just taken the knee there. C.J. Verdell also fumbled, though, right? In these kind of situations in the second half, yes, he is at fault for not knowing what to do in that situation or not understanding the rule that Justin Herbert can't go in the game. It's also not his fault, though, that you dropped a pass in the back of the end zone and your veteran quarterback fumbled at the 8-yard line after an 80-yard return. And that's where I want to make sure people are fair in their criticism of how you're spreading it out. I have no problem saying Cristobal needs to be better, especially in the second half. Arroyo needs to be better making adjustments. But it goes hand in hand. The guys can't make mistakes, because if they do and you're up 28-3 at the end of the first half, like you probably should have been, or 24-3 at the worst, we're not having this conversation. Bo Nix is forced to throw the entire second half. You lean on him a little bit, and Oregon's going to find a way to win that game. That's where I just think you need to spread the blame out a little bit.
The only thing I would say to you, though, is then how many more games before you conclude? This is a coaching thing, and it's not a player thing. You're right. Players drop passes. Players fumble the ball. He's not calling up, hey, CJ, we're running the clock out versus Stanford. Can you fumble right now and make this interesting? Right. He obviously wants to win these games, right? You stood right next to him when they beat Washington. What was he like?
He was
running around the field. Yeah. He was jacked because he had Kayvon Thibodeau in attendance, a 5-star DN edge rusher. He was recruiting at a high level, and he knew that was a big game. He knows what that means to the Oregon fan, right? So he's not drawing this up, but how many more times does this happen before you reach the conclusion, this is a coaching thing. This really is a problem that it needs to be addressed. Can it be addressed? How many more? Like one, two?
Yeah, I mean, if you're blowing games like this and coaching management is a big issue with it going forward, depends on, one, how you're blowing it, what kind of mistakes are the players making.
Let's say it's very similar in nature. It's a second half. You kind of collapse a little bit. The team comes back against
you. If this
you.
Becomes a trend and it happens a couple of more times, like against Stanford or Washington State or USC, whatever the case, then absolutely. And I do think that Marcus Arroyo should be on the hot seat and coaching for his job this year. He has to show the ability to make adjustments, because the one thing we know out of the Auburn game, if you're preparing to play Oregon and you sit down and you watch that film, what film are you going to lean on defensively? You're going to lean on what Auburn did in the second half, and that's putting nine guys in the box, jamming wide receivers, blitzing the hell out of Herbert, not giving him any time to throw the football, taking away the run game, right? Like, that's the film Nevada's going to use and Montana's going to use and Stanford's going to use. So you have to show that you have a counterpunch to what teams are going to throw at you, and that's where it gets back to coaching, and he needs to prove that throughout the course of the season, not only can he respond to that, but when something new is thrown at you, that you can readjust and throw a counterpunch back
at it. And I know we're in the day and age where everybody wants to, they got to get the take in early, right? Because if you get the take in early and then your take happens, guys, I've been telling you this for months. Guys, I knew this was going to happen. When it doesn't, though, those people never really remind you that they used to believe something, right? I think back to when this job was open and it started kind of picking up momentum that his name was there. Like, oh, he's not just an interview. Like, the players want him. Mm-hmm. Recruits are tweeting about him staying. And I remember we were doing shows during that time, and I said, yeah, maybe him, but you can't aim higher than him. And I questioned it. I really did. Now, they won nine games last year. We were critical of the Stanford game, right? We're critical of Arizona game. For the most part, though, my point is, as a guy that still questioned him being hired in general, I'm still not ready to proclaim anything.
No.
And I think it's a bit extreme. If you want to go that route, go that route. But I do think it's a bit extreme still to jump to a conclusion that this guy is not going to win at a high level at Oregon. You know, one takeaway that I had from that game, amongst all the how the hell they blow this, what are they doing, one takeaway I really had, Oregon's getting better. Oregon was pushing around a highly touted defensive line in that first half.
It was considered one of the best defensive lines in the country.
Oh, some people think it's the number one. And they really showed me something. Penei Sewell was a beast in that game. And even though that they choked that game away and they lost, I would still look at the Pac-12 and say, for as good as they played, how many other teams in this conference are better than them? Now, the areas of in-game coaching and going on the road,
and they're not going to go away until you prove them wrong.
Right, and they shouldn't. But I also did take away a positive of, he is kind of forming what he's looking for, right? His offensive line didn't get quite that push in the second half, and they lost that running game. But man, in that first half, once they can get to a point of having solid wide receivers out there or a little more depth where your backups are in and you're not really Googling, Addison, I thought he left a couple years ago. That's a new Addison.
Right,
Googling.
Right.
Right. Until you get to that point, you're still going to have moments like this against some of the other national known brands from time to time. But guys, he might not be very far away from getting to that point. He might be one more season away. And I still think this year, even if he doesn't have those things, Dirt, they can still win the North.
Yeah, the frustrating part out of a game like this to open the season is everybody wants to have a final take. Like,
absolutely.
This is it. This is who Oregon's going to be. This is who the coaches are. Herbert's overrated. Arroyo sucks. They can't win. They choke in the big game. There you go. Season's over. When in reality, you have 11 games left, and the narrative can be completely different. And I think back to last year in the reverse. Remember when Oregon beat Washington and what people were saying and national columnists were running with their back and are they a dark horse to make the playoff? And then things flipped completely the next week and the season fell apart. Like, because something happened in week one of the season doesn't mean it's going to happen for the next 11 games. And I think that's where you just have to let this one breathe a little bit. They're under pressure to improve on the clock management and game management. They're under pressure to prove that they can make in-game adjustments. Herbert's under pressure to go win some of those games, and they're going to have close games. Stanford, Washington, USC, Washington State. The schedule's not easy for Oregon, and they're going to have a chance to prove a lot of people wrong down the stretch. Now it's up to them to go change this narrative of coaching sucks, Herbert sucks, and they can't win anything.
But if it doesn't change,
yeah, then it's a valid conversation.
And that's why I'm going to allow a little more time here. There's absolute criticism deserved to be on multiple people within that program. But like, running with the conclusion that he will never win, that he will hold them back, I'm not ready to do that yet. I'm not. All right, we got a loaded second hour. We're going to start it. Oregon State's defense somehow got worse, and the Pac-12 weekend was very interesting. Hour two straight ahead. Dirt and Sprague back with more on The Fan.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.